One of the challenges we have on Sound Cues is that we get a lot of really interesting listener questions, and we don't have the time or the resources to answer all of them. Now, obviously, this is a great problem to have. So many good questions, so little time. So this week, our friends on The Record helped us out. This is Sound Cues, a podcast fueled by listener curiosity. I'm your host, Deborah Wong. And this week, with help from KUOW's The Record, we answer questions about everything from tree health to what's going on at the new Burke Museum in Seattle. We get a lot of questions about trees. What's happening to this fir? Is my maple going to die? What's this weird mold? People are really curious about trees, so we figured it was time to take a walk in the park.
Oh no, is it a cherry? No. I think it's a yellow birch. Holy smoke.
That's Roy Hissler. He's a manager in the Bellevue office of Davey Tree Experts. He's been working with trees for 45 years, and he's seen it all.
You know, there's many factors that affect trees in the urban environment, you know, compaction, being too wet, being too dry, the weather. We had the worst drought we had in the past couple years, you know, and we're seeing a lot of damage from that. You could see it 1, 2, 3 years down the road, you know, and a lot of those stresses from drought or a super wet. I know we're wet here during the winter all the time, but if it's really wet, those extremes stress trees out. They don't have a chance. They get damaged by being too dry during the summer, and then the roots get damaged even more being too wet during the winter, and those extremes don't give the roots a chance to grow. And it's those fine little root hairs that are the feeding or sucking part of the tree that keeps it going.
All right, so droughts are a thing, but it's slow moving, the kind of damage you don't notice right away. As Roy was saying, the drought we had was about 2 years ago now, and we're only just seeing the damage. But what about when trees experience more rapid decline? When you poke your head outside one day and you find your entire tree has turned brown, seemingly overnight?
That's a slow process, you know. You may think it all of a sudden it's brown, but it's been a slow process to get it brown. Unless there was some immediate damage, like severe root damage, you know, from construction or irrigation, lighting.
So when Roy says construction can do damage, he means to the roots of your tree, not just like a crane falling on top of it, which can be difficult to notice at first. Say you're putting in a new water line. You might cut the roots by accident, and then there's not much a tree can do if it's not getting fed and watered.
Or, you know, there's different leaf disease issues that happen in the spring. A lot of times evergreens stay green all winter, and then all of a sudden the spring comes, the root system can't support it, and it crashes real quick.
Okay, so leaf diseases, cutting roots, drought, just some of the things that can affect tree health. But how are you supposed to know how your tree is doing? I mean, short of calling an arborist. To answer that, we picked a tree at Seattle's Cowan Park and pulled down a branch.
You know, here, you look at the growth from this year and holy smoke, it. You know, what's that? Okay. 10 inches, you know. And there's the bud scars from the bud, this terminal bud here. So there's 1 year. There's 2 years ago. There's 3 years ago. It was a little bit short here.
What Roy is looking for here is new growth, the fresh wood that grows out of the end of a branch.
Certain trees have a certain amount of twig growth during the summer. So that's one thing this time of year, I look at the twig growth from the summer. And because I know the growth rates of certain trees, I look, and if it's like it's today, I was looking at this cherry for a homeowner. The twig growth this year was a half inch. Usually it should be like 4 or 5 inches. So that's telling me, hey, that tree's stressing. And then you can follow from the bud scars all the way back on a twig about 4 or 5 years and see the twig growth. So that's one way to tell. Then the other thing is in the late summer, all the trees have their leaves, but some leaves start falling off early. That's a sign of stress, you know, where you have 5 big leaf maples here, and they all have their leaves, but then you have another one over here and the leaves are falling off. Early fall colorization, that's a sign of stress. But you got to watch it. Once you get into, you know, September, October, you know, that early fall colorization is actually fall colorization, you know. So, but that's what happens. I look for dead branches in the tree, you know, hanging branches. We call it live crown ratio. Now it's hard because the leaves are falling off. But I can look at a tree and say, all right, that has about 90% of the live crown ratio. But if I get a white pine that has half of that foliage this time of year, that's telling me something's wrong.
Now, if trees are sensitive to drought, what does that mean as we face rising temperatures from climate change? Roy says there are some things we can do.
If the temperature continue to rise, yes. You know, we're going to have drought situations where we have to supplement on water, mulch, fertilize to promote the health and vigor of a tree, you know, so it can help naturally fight off insects and diseases and stresses from environmental climatic conditions. Everybody says, oh, I'm watering my lawn, right? Or they're watering their trees. I go out there and I stick my finger in the ground an inch and down and it's bone dry, you know? So proper watering, you know, manage your water, find out where your water is going. One area could have too much water. Another area could not enough water. So managing your water. When I say when you water, go out and check when you're done. You know, and normally a good soil content with moisture in it is when you squeeze it, it doesn't smell, water doesn't come dripping out of it, and it holds together a little bit. Not when you put it in your hand, squeeze it, and it's powder. That's too dry. When it smells and water's dripping out of it, it's too wet. And again, trees and shrubs need more moisture than your lawn, you know. I mean, I gave up watering my lawn. I don't water it anymore.
It's comforting to know that people like Roy are keeping an eye on our trees. People are really into them, considering the number of questions we've gotten. But why do we care?
People are very emotional about their trees, you know, and they care about them a lot. You know, I have some clients that won't let me prune their tree when they're home because they don't want to see the pruning. But it's helping the tree, but they think we're kind of hurting it and stuff.
Because they worry that the tree is getting hurt.
Yeah. Tell them, don't worry about it. Call a certified arborist, not just a regular arborist. Anybody can call them. Have a certified arborist, have them come out and talk to you about your trees.
What if they're just worried about the trees in general? Not necessarily their trees, but if they're just like, you know, on the highway, they're driving past National Forest or whatever,
yeah.
And they're just worried.
Oh, they shouldn't worry, you know. Mother Nature is Mother Nature, and Mother Nature had her hand on the world since day one and even before then, you know. And that's just going to happen, you know. And, hey, one day there was dinosaurs running around here. Now it's us. The earth will be here a long time after us.
And hopefully the trees will be as well. Next on the record, have you ever heard of Roy Olmsted, radio host, bootlegger, and born-again prohibitionist? We're unpacking the history of Seattle's Roy Olmsted next on the record. I'm Deborah Wong.
On the Radioactive Youth Media Podcast, teens tell stories we're not hearing anywhere else.
We're both queer and both brown and both Muslim.
Subscribe for stories that reflect our world.
On March 14th, we walked out of our classes. Today, we marched to the streets of Seattle. And in November, we'll vote. And in a few years, you'll see us running for office.
Download the Radioactive Podcast at kow.org/podcast.
I'm Deborah Wong, and this is a special Sound Cues takeover of The Record. We got a question from a listener recently that had most of us here at Sound Cues stumped. The question read, I would like to learn more about Seattle bootlegger Roy Olmsted, about his rise to fame, reputation of upholding moral standards in an illegal industry at the time, and then his 180-degree flip to a born-again Christian in prison. To answer this question, we go to our go-to guy for Seattle history, Leonard Garfield, the director of the Museum of History and Industry. Hey, Leonard.
Hey, Deborah.
Well, the question got us intrigued because we had never heard of this guy, although I did wonder whether he had some connection to the famous Olmsted brothers who designed some of our wonderful parks.
Well, no connection to the Olmsted park designers, but if you lived in Seattle in the 1920s, Roy Olmsted is a person that you would know all about. He was kind of a hero in town, even though he was also the leading criminal. And that's really the interesting story.
So tell us about Roy Olmsted.
Well, he was from the Midwest. He grew up on a farm, and he came to Seattle in the early 20th century, like a lot of folks did. Our community was booming. And you know, he got one of his first jobs in the shipyards down on the Elliott Bay waterfront. He worked for Moran Brothers Shipyards. We became a big shipbuilding city, and thousands of people worked in the shipyards. That's where Olmsted got his first break. But it wasn't too long before he discovered that he really had an aptitude for police work and joined the police force. And quickly after joining, he was promoted by the police chief to become a lieutenant, which was a very important position. So he had a pretty successful career in Seattle right from the start. In fact, 100 years ago this year, he became an officer in the Seattle Police Department. And one of his assignments was to look for bootleggers, those people illegally smuggling alcohol into the United States during Prohibition. He got busted for that. He was a little loose in how he was carrying out his illegal operations, and he got kicked out of the police department. But, you know, it was a good news, bad news story. The bad news was he lost his job. The good news is he quickly became the most successful bootlegger in the Northwest.
So there was a lot of money to be made at the time in bootlegging?
Roy Olmsted made $200,000 a month in the early 1920s. Now imagine that in today's money. He was a very wealthy man, and actually he employed a lot of people. He put a lot of money in other people's pockets. In fact, it was said at the time that he was the largest employer in the city of Seattle.
No, yep. Seriously?
It's true. Everybody was either on the payroll of Olmsted or they were being paid off by Olmsted. It was quite a network that allowed alcohol to come into Seattle and made this officially dry city very, very liquor-filled during Prohibition.
So I'm guessing he had just a very loyal customer base during Prohibition?
Well, nobody could refuse Roy Olmsted because he was affable, he was pleasant, he was sort of the ideal good criminal. He did not believe in guns. He did not dilute his alcohol. It was always the very highest quality. He was proud of those things, and he won a loyal customer base.
So his customers were speakeasies and individuals? Anyone that we know?
Well, people we do know, and I'm a little shy to say who they were, but say the founders of a major airplane manufacturer were customers, reputedly. A prominent gentleman's club in downtown Seattle was a customer of Olmsted, as were speakeasies all over town, from those in the Central District to those in the city's most exclusive neighborhoods. It really was, Olmsted really served a clientele that covered the demographic basis of our city. You know, Seattle was a boom town in the 1920s. We were making money hand over fist. Thousands of people had come in to work in the shipyards, in the airplane factory, and the real estate was growing around the region. So the parties were quite large and fun and wild in many cases. Photographs in the museum's collection show parties of people dressed to the nines in black tie and gowns, drinking their illegal whiskey. And in other cases, you had roadhouses that were filled with people in their casual clothes out for a night of drinking and dancing. All of it unified by the fact that it was illegal, and all of it unified by the fact that Roy Olmsted was there ready to fill their glasses.
And people didn't care about being photographed at the time?
And apparently they didn't care about being photographed, because we have hundreds of photographs at Mohai showing these parties in progress, and each one of them was illegal.
And the speakeasies were where? I mean, were they like Pioneer Square?
Absolutely.
Capitol
Pioneer
Hill?
Square, Capitol Hill, the Central District, up in Shoreline area, down in the Burien area. They all had their own little
everywhere.
Secret signs of how you could get in. You sometimes would have to knock a certain way or say a certain code at the door to be let in. Much of that was really just a formality, because the authorities really knew where these places were, but people were willing to look the other way because so many people participated in these that if there had been a severe uniform crackdown, it would have probably caused, you know, some serious consternation on the part of otherwise law-abiding citizens.
Did he have any competition at the time, or was he pretty much the only game in town?
You know, he had lots of competition, and you know who competed with him in part were the moonshiners in eastern King County. You know all those hills we have and those mountains where there were perfect hollows and hideaways for brewing your own liquor, and that liquor also got sold. It was often of very low quality and sometimes completely dangerous to drink. But that, in a sense, was a competition for Olmsted. It made Olmsted all the more popular because his liquor was the highest quality Canadian liquor, which of course is world famous. So we really were getting the best stuff in Seattle through Olmsted. But beyond the moonshiners in eastern King County, he really had a monopoly. He really had a lock on the illegal alcohol business in our community.
Okay, so how did this operation work? Where did all this liquor come from, and how did it get here?
Well, it was a complicated network. It all began in Canada. Olmsted went up to Canada and took advantage of some early trade relations between Canada and Mexico. He supposedly bought liquor in Canada for shipment to Mexico. That's what he told the Canadian authorities. But in fact, of course, what he did was he shipped it secretly, surreptitiously, to the United States on a series of shipments that would ply the Puget Sound in the dark, land on islands in the Puget Sound that were hard to get to, and eventually deliver it at night on the shorelines up and down our community, in the shorelines as far south as Burien, as far north as the Highlands, all over the place. And from there, it was a network of rum runners, people who would actually carry the liquor from the boats to bars and restaurants and speakeasies all over town.
And when you say rum, it wasn't just rum, right?
It wasn't just rum. It was all kinds of alcohol and the very best quality. So we have a lot to thank, not just to Olmsted, but to our friends in Canada for providing us with terrific spirits during the 1920s.
Now, if this was such a big operation, how did he get away with it?
Well, in part, he got away with it by not getting away with it, by simply paying off people. In fact, he bought the silence and he bought the authorities permission to look the other way. Everybody knew that Olmsted was a criminal, and a lot of people were willing to overlook it. You know, Deborah, it's funny. During the 1920s, bootleggers were sometimes viewed as being beneficent because, after all, they were supplying us with a much beloved product, even one that was illegal. But what made Olmsted so special in the 20s is where bootleggers and rum runners in other communities in the United States were often violent. They often had other criminal activities. They were their bootlegging was just part of a vast criminal network. Olmsted was a peaceful criminal. He did not engage in violence. He did not engage in other criminal activity. He really was a kind of a straight-up businessman, except that his business was technically against the law. In that respect, authorities in Seattle were willing to look the other way, but the federal authorities were not, and that's where Olmsted ran into some trouble.
Am I correct in understanding that he actually ran a radio station as well?
Well, this is another amazing fact about Roy Olmsted. Roy and his second wife, Elise, who was a woman from London and had quite an interesting backstory, which we won't go into, but Roy and Elise Olmsted decided to start a legitimate business. They were going to create a radio station. Now, this was really at the birth of radio and really a heyday of radio, the explosion of radio stations. So they created a station in their home on Mount Baker. They had a really palatial home on the very crest of Mount Baker. It's still there today. You can see it as you cross the I-90 bridge. It's a real landmark. Wow. And that's where they had the radio station. And they had a great set of programs. And one of the most popular was Aunt Vivian. That's where Elise Olmsted would read children's stories over the air.
And there were some coded messages in
there
this?
There's a follow-up to that, because in Aunt Vivian's stories were coded messages to the smugglers in Olmsted's network up and down the coast of the Puget Sound, telling folks when and where to drop their alcohol. So while kids were huddled around the radio listening to tales, fairy tales and so forth, the rum runners were getting their cues and they were making the delivery to Olmsted's network. It really was a remarkable story. There's a little bit of apocryphalness, if you will, in that. We don't know exactly how the coded messages were done, and we don't actually know if there are existing tapes of Elise's broadcasts. But the story was a very popular one, and it led federal investigators to actually wiretap Olmsted's house to see if they could find out more about this business.
Okay, and this is what led to his downfall?
It did indeed. The federal officers decided that they had to get the goods on Olmsted. They knew he was a bootlegger. He was widely known in the community. He was really flaunting the law. So they placed wiretaps on his phone, and they did capture conversations on the phone between Olmsted and other folks in the community talking about the importation of illegal alcohol. They used that as information to actually capture him in the act of making a business transaction. They arrested him, and they arrested dozens and dozens of associates connected with him in what ended up being one of the largest trials in the history of illegal alcohol importation during the Prohibition era, anywhere in the country. There were up to almost 90 defendants who were caught up in this sweep. But at the very head of the pyramid was Roy Olmsted.
And so he ends up being convicted, going to prison. He actually
appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, arguing that this wiretapping was illegal, correct?
Right. He never doubted the fact or denied the fact that he was a bootlegger. He admitted guilty as charged. But what he said was illegal was the law enforcement officials who wiretapped his phones, which he claimed was a violation of his constitutional right to privacy. Familiar theme, one that we're still fighting today. It did go all the way to the Supreme Court. And in a landmark case of appropriately named Olmstead versus the United States, Roy Olmstead was found guilty that, in fact, the wiretapping was legal. It was a constitutionally protected method of collecting evidence in a criminal trial.
Okay, so he goes to prison, and that's not the end of the story.
Well, Olmstead was flexible, right? He went from a police officer one year to the biggest criminal in Seattle the next. He went to prison in the early 1920s, and after he got out a few years later, he became a passionate Christian. He became a person who went on the speaking circuit. He was all about creating, helping people reform themselves, and he became an advocate for sobriety. So he began to advocate against the very product that he had made so much money from. And actually, believe it or not, he was released from prison and prohibition was still in effect. So the bootlegger got out while prohibition was still happening, but he himself never returned to that life of crime.
How did prohibition last for so long? Well, I mean, 13 years, right?
13 years. Well, you know, it's a reflection of nativism. There was an element of racism in it. There was a strand of fear in it that somehow all of the problems of a changing world and a fast-growing community were all because people were drinking too much. Just a huge simplification of the challenges. And just as quickly as people fell toward that stereotype, people fell away from it as the Depression descended. And people realized that our problems were much more grave than just some people having, you know, too much to drink. That really there were many more social and economic issues we really needed to grapple with. People realized that prohibition was just a distraction. All it was really doing in the end was creating criminals out of both the bootleggers and those who consumed alcohol. And that was pretty much almost everybody in the country. And people wisely decided that this wasn't the way to approach change or other challenges we face. But it is a reminder that trying to regulate morality or trying to identify simple solutions to complex problems is still something that we grapple with today. And we might want to look at prohibition and see what really were the causes and effects of that long period in American history. And I think we would probably learn from that it was not a wise approach to solving anybody's problems.
I grew up in Chicago where we had Al Capone and, you know, lots of sort of bloody tales of what it was like during Prohibition. Was that not Seattle? I mean, did Seattle have a different history of Prohibition?
Oh, absolutely. They called Olmstead the gentleman bootlegger, and really that sense of civility, that sense of cordiality and fair play. I mean, he knew he was up against the police, but he wouldn't engage in gunplay. He knew that he was selling an illegal product, but it was always the highest quality. He knew his customers were both wealthy and not so well-to-do, and he never tried to take advantage of them. He really was kind of a model citizen, and in a way, he reminds me that Seattle is a community that has a kind of civic ethic that believes in fair play and cooperation. And to that extent, Olmstead was very much a Seattleite.
It's an amazing story. And it makes me wonder whether it's just a little bit too perfect. I mean, was he really the nice guy that people make him out to be? Or is it possible that there's any revisionism going on in this history?
Well, you know, every piece of evidence, Deborah, suggests that he was really a nice guy. He was really liked. His parties were popular. His radio shows were popular. People in the police force before he was first arrested really enjoyed the guy. He really was a kind of an upstanding guy. He just was upstanding a little bit on the wrong side of things. But he also was, I would say, that classic Seattle personality type. He was a little idiosyncratic. There was something about him that made him different than the kind of criminal you'd run into in Chicago or in New York or in St. Louis. He was just a nice guy who did things his own way, a little bit quirky in keeping with the Seattle spirit. But I think there's no evidence to suggest that he was anything other than Roy Olmstead, the golden-hearted rum runner.
Leonard Garfield is the director of the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle. Leonard, thanks so much for coming in. And if you want even more information on Roy Olmstead, you are in luck. As Leonard mentioned, Roy's a bit of a legend. And legend status means he's been immortalized in books, in papers, and he was even featured in Ken Burns' documentary series, Prohibition. The episode was called The Good Bootlegger.
On March 22nd, 1920, 2 months after Prohibition went into effect. At an isolated dock a few miles north of Seattle, Washington, 11 men labored to load sacks of Canadian whiskey from a speed launch into 6 waiting automobiles.
Stay with us, because coming up next, we'll meet a Native American artist whose work features prominently in the new Burke Museum. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. From KUOW, this is The Record. Finally today, we want to introduce you to an artist who plays a big role in the reboot of a beloved cultural institution.
My name is Ryan Feddersen. I am a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Caldwell Reservation, Okanagan and Arrow Lakes, and I am a visual artist based in Tacoma, Washington.
I meet Ryan Feddersen at the Washington State Museum of Natural History and Culture, better known as the Burke Museum. The Burke has just moved into a brand new state-of-the-art building on the University of Washington campus. Ryan leads me up a staircase along a massive wall.
And it's absolutely huge.
I think it's about, the wall itself was 40 by 60, and it starts about 7 feet up from the ground and ends about 3 feet from the ceiling.
It's 3 stories high, and it's filled with intriguing symbols that Ryan has created. They're black and white, and they cascade down from the ceiling in columns.
We start at the top corner with a section of a mastodon skull, which transforms into a crane, which references the mastodon that was found during construction at South Lake Union.
The mural is meant to depict the amazing variety of objects that are housed at the Burke and the ways in which they connect to life outside. The Burke's collections contain everything from dinosaur bones to bird specimens to handmade cedar canoes, 16 million pieces in all.
During the process, I got to work with almost every section of the Burke's research, and I met with the researchers and talked about both their favorite specimens and as well as the type of work that they were doing in their study.
Ryan grew up in a family of artists. She creates large-scale interactive installations that often touch on the recent history of Indigenous people. About 5 years ago, she was invited by the Burke to spend time researching the items in the museum's collection of Native American art. The Burke's Bill Holmes Center provides grants to Indigenous artists so they can have the opportunity to connect with pieces from their heritage. The collection is kept under lock and key. It's massive, filling row upon row of huge metal drawers and shelves, although one wall of the room is now made of glass, so visitors can see some of what's in there. Ryan says when she first explored the collection, she realized it was full of surprises.
And so I think that's one of the things I find most exciting about it, is finding the really weird works. There's a twined cornrow basket that looks like it has DNA spirals from it, that's very multicolored, very unique and different from the repetitive abstract patterns you often see.
Ryan says people often have a very narrow view of what Native American art is. They might be familiar with certain iconic images, which she says have almost become stereotypes. She was interested in the unusual pieces in the collection, like the variety of decorated containers made of rawhide, which are called parflesh.
They're made in all different types of sizes and shapes. This one's really fantastic, if we want to pull this one down.
The designs are wonderful, but Ryan says what she's most interested in is understanding the artist's methodologies, figuring out conceptually how they were constructed, and then bringing those lessons into her practice. Now, the Burke is the oldest museum in Washington State. Some of its pieces were collected back in the late 1800s. And for Ryan, it's a really complicated history.
There are a lot of very beautiful and powerful objects that are here. It's an honor to be able to look through them, and particularly as a researching artist to be able to handle them and seek inspiration and an understanding for them. Sometimes it's hard to see things in this setting, in shelves and boxes and put away, because that's not typically their purpose.
That feeling of discomfort is pretty common when Native artists first see the massive collection, according to Burke Museum staff. Katie Bunn Marcuse is the curator of Northwest Native Art at the Burke.
There's often a very mixed sense of emotions because there's joy at finding things and visiting with artworks and belongings that have come from your community and to see those again, and huge sadness that they left in the first place and that there were generations of people who were under circumstances, persecutions that meant that those kinds of pieces left their community, whether it was for religious reasons or economic reasons or other reasons why things end up in a museum collection.
The Burke uses a strong word to describe how museums once operated. They call it colonialism. Visitors to the museum are greeted with a statement that acknowledges that museums often disconnected cultural belongings and art from people and their homes, and that museums often undervalue the involvement of communities in their own heritage. Katie Bunn Marcuse says the Burke has been striving for years to change that narrative.
We're very aware that museums have a fraught relationship with Indigenous communities, and we are working very hard to find the right ways to move forward together and to change, hopefully, museums and our policies and practices for the better.
And one of the ways they're trying to make that change is by inviting community members to be a part of the decisions the museum makes. The Burke asked Ryan and five other Native women artists to curate the first exhibition in the new Native Arts Gallery.
And it's looking at both contemporary and traditional Native American work.
Ryan made the decision to choose only works by known artists. She says many of the items in the collection do not have a name of an artist associated with them. She says that's another legacy of how collectors once objectified Native art. They valued the object and not the person who produced it.
At some point, somebody knew who created each one of these things. Everything was created by a person. Things were collected over time in a lot of different ways that didn't necessarily record or reflect the creator, even if it would have been known at the time that it was collected.
Ryan says another of her goals is to use art to create social change. She says she hopes to spur conversations that are different from what people would normally have in a museum setting.
For me, that is an intentional artistic disruption, and I have been very appreciative with the Burke's willingness to invite me into their spaces to be a little disruptive.
That's Native American artist Ryan Feddersen. You can see her work at the new Burke Museum on the University of Washington campus. Thank you for listening to the special Sound Cues takeover of The Record. Sound Cues answers your questions about the character and people of the place we call home. We're just finishing up season two of our podcast, and coming soon, we explore why Seattle has such a rich nerd culture, which is something I've always wondered as well. If you have a question you want answered, go to kuow.org/soundcues and drop us a note. Today's show was produced by Sarah Leibovitz, along with Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrempong, and Brandy Fullwood. I'm Deborah Wong. Thanks for joining us, and happy Native American Heritage Day!